This is the Larry Mueller Show on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Jill Najoe. Larry is out with a spring cold today, and we are all wishing him a speedy recovery. Now, our topic today is a little more serious than a cold, and we're talking about medical directives and advanced health care plans with our first guest. With us are Dr. Tim Jessick, a doctor of osteopathy and palliative medicine. He's a palliative medicine physician who also teaches at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, and Sarah McGalty. I was going to get that wrong. I knew I was going to get it wrong. I'm sorry, Sarah. Sarah Micheletti, right?
That's it.
Micheletti. I got it. Micheletti. Ryu, an attorney at McCarty Law LLP in Appleton. She specializes in estate planning and elder law. So what questions do you have about making your health care plan? So join the conversation and give us a call at 800-642-1234. And of course, you can send an email, and that's to talk@wpr.org. Sarah, Dr. Jessick, thank you so much for taking time to join us today. We really appreciate that.
Thank you for having us, Jill.
You bet. Important topic. We try to cover it every year. You guys are new to us. So let's talk a little bit about you just so we kind of know your background. Dr. Jessick, excuse me, talk a little bit about your background for us.
Sure. Thank you so much, Jill. This is a great opportunity. As you mentioned, I'm a palliative medicine physician. So I really talk to patients and families that have chronic, serious, and life-limiting illnesses. So really good advanced care planning, a lot of discussions by physicians and patients and families is just so, so important. So by the time I see them, maybe towards the last year or two of life, we have some of those discussions and decisions made. So super important topic today.
Okay, and Sarah, how does this fit into what you do in your job?
Yes, thank you, Jill. Thanks for having us. I'm an attorney. I have been practicing for almost 2 decades now. I specialize in estate planning, guardianships, probate, and elder law. I help families prepare for the possibility that one of them, that people will become incapacitated. I help people when they don't make good plans for when that happens. And that's a focus of a lot of my practice. I hope that we can help people communicate decisions in advance so that we don't have to guess about what people's wishes are.
Right. And I think a lot of times we think about this and we think about those who are elderly in our family, but that's not necessarily the case, is it? Dr. Jessick, why don't you talk a little bit about this? Should be really everybody should have this, shouldn't they?
Absolutely. What a great point, Jill. We kind of are afraid of having these conversations because talking about this can be scary. But I think part of what Sarah and I try to do is normalize these conversations. It's very empowering for folks, even at a young age, start thinking about who could make decisions for me if I can't. Heaven forbid I'm in a car accident or something. Who do I trust? Who knows me well enough to make decisions for me? And how can I get that paperwork done? So even though we think about folks when they're getting older having these discussions, you know, I'm sure Sarah does this all the time. Even at the age of 18 and older, we're encouraging good advanced care planning and hey, you're going off to college. You know, let's get this document done. Let's pick somebody so we at least have the physical document done. And let's start having some of these conversations really early. So by the time you do get elderly, by the time this becomes more and more practical or urgent, oh, I've had those discussions multiple times. It's not scary anymore for me.
That makes a whole lot of sense. Now, legally, Sarah, when someone turns 18, their parents can't answer these questions for them, can they?
That's absolutely accurate. Yeah, I was thinking about two different things here. The first is, you know, when clients come in to see me and we do an estate plan for mom and dad, a lot of times they say, oh, my kid just turned 18. They're at college. Can we do what do they need? And my answer is always good health care and financial power of attorney documents, because if anything ever happened to them and they were in the hospital, really the hospital can't even tell the parents that their kid is there. So having a good advance directive and power of attorney documents is vital to that. I always think about the story when I was in college. my dad had me sign a power of attorney document. And I had a problem. Now, this was a while ago, of course, but I think this still applies. I had a problem with my credit card while I was there, and my dad was able to solve the problem for me because I had a power of attorney in place. So, yes, we're talking about the accidents, the problems. We're also talking about the convenience of having those documents in place.
Yeah, I think parents just kind of assume, well, I'm their parents, I can take care of it. But that is not the case. So for those people who are graduating, it's probably part of a good gift to give a graduate is just this power of attorney, power of medical attorney. So definitely. So let's get into this. So what documents are we talking about specifically here, Sarah?
Yeah, so there's a number of different documents. I think the medical side of things, there's sort of two documents that we talk about. The one is the healthcare power of attorney document. That document names a healthcare power of attorney agent, someone you've selected to make your healthcare choices for you. That document outlines the different types of authority that you want to give that person. If you want to give that person the authority to admit you to a long-term care facility, withhold or withdraw a feeding tube, or make decisions while that person is pregnant, for example. Now, if you check the no boxes on those things, they're still going to happen, but we're going to require a guardianship to make those things happen. So we do encourage folks to check those yes boxes on that document. The second document is called a declaration to physicians or a living will. That document usually asks some important questions about what type of care you want if you are in a persistent vegetative state or have other illnesses that would require someone to make decisions for you. And I think Dr. Jessica can probably talk about how they look at those documents. But those are the two that concern healthcare. There's other documents as well, like a financial power of attorney, which would be equally important to fill out.
Sure. Okay, so let's go to you, Dr. Jessica. Number one, how do you get those documents? Because you can fill them out all you want, but if you just keep them in your file drawer, that's not going to help you.
It's not helpful at all, Jill. You're absolutely right. You know, hanging up on the fridge doesn't help us when we're in the hospital, right? So this is the key part, and Sarah can jump in too, is not only completing the documents, completing it with a trained facilitator, a trained attorney that knows how to do this, right? But then discussing this with others, but really importantly, hey, bring that document to your physician in the clinic. Make sure they scan it. Make sure they get it into electronic medical records. So we have access to that in the hospital. So we can review that quickly. So we don't have to make you go home and bring that to us in the hospital. So, you know, having them available, scanning them is super, super important. Probably not a bad idea if you have a loved one comes into the hospital, just in case, to bring your extra copy with you so you have it in your purse or your wallet or with you so you can show it to folks. But that's exactly, as a physician, I'm going to be looking for. If a patient can't make their own decisions, who do they trust most to make decisions for them? Who do I go to? Mm-hmm. And Sarah can talk about this also, but in the state of Wisconsin, it's not going to always automatically be my wife. It's not going to be your spouse or your adult children and things like that. So I can't, as a physician, assume that who that person's going to be. And clearly, you know, patients and families don't want me as the doc to make all the decisions for them.
Yeah, that puts you in a really difficult position when there isn't one of those and some decisions have to be made. And, you know, you're worried about the health care. You shouldn't have to worry about the legal part of it. But that is part of what you do have to be concerned about.
Yeah, absolutely right. And it's as much of a stressor, I think, to the family members of the poor patient that can't respond. And mm-hmm. I think you brought it up earlier, Jill. It's a gift. What a gift to think about this ahead of time and share these wishes and complete these documents ahead of time, as difficult as it might be. What a gift to your family so they don't have to struggle.
Right. Now, Sarah, when you help someone fill this out, all these documents, do you then take the next step for them to get them to their physician and get them in the medical records, or is that something that your client has to do for themselves?
Great question. So we have assisted folks in getting power of attorney documents to the right people. I have also made many copies for people of the documents so that they have enough to disseminate to the important people that need them. I also, though, encourage folks to send those documents or bring them right to their doctor's office. I always say they'll scan it in and make it part of your electronic medical file. And it's way better for them to have that document in advance. And then it's there if it's ever needed. It kind of sleeps, right, in that medical file until it's ready to be used. It's so important that people know where it is. Otherwise, you've just taken all that effort to do this really important thing. And then if no one knows about it, it's never going to be useful. So it's very, very important that people know that you've completed those documents. And I do want to just plug the State Bar's resources. We do have a gift to your family guide that we've made available during Healthcare Decisions Week this week. It will be available from April 9th to April 24th, free to anybody. It's available on the State Bar of Wisconsin's website and has some really great resources for folks if they're interested.
I think we have a link to that on our website too. So if you just go to wpr.org/Larry, that should be available when the recording of this is available, which is about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So you can go there too. But it's easy enough to just, you know, go in and search for. So as you had mentioned, this is Healthcare Decisions Week in Wisconsin, and the governor has signed that in. And Dr. Jessic, why is that an important thing for the governor? He does that pretty much every year, like we have mentioned. Why is it important to have that out there?
I think it's hugely important. A lot of folks still don't know what they don't know, or they make assumptions. So, you know, we take a whole week to remind folks, hey, this is still important. We still need to get this done. For those of you that got your advance directive done, awesome. For those that haven't, hey, now's a good time to be thinking about this and to complete those. So it's really great to raise that awareness for folks. Just as a reminder, I think the other piece is that, you know, for folks that have never done this before, hey, let's get them done. They're easy, and even the governor's supporting this, right? But even for folks that have had them done in the past, in the state of Wisconsin, they have laws. And one of them is, if you go through a divorce, Sarah, correct me if I'm wrong, if you have a divorce, that document is null and void. So if you're saying, oh, I'm glad the governor told me to get this done last year, I got it done, I'm good to go for the next 50 years, yeah, you might want to get, well, you need to get that redone. So I think it's a great reminder for all of us to that, yeah, get them done and keep them updated.
It's kind of like a reminder to change the batteries in your smoke detector, right?
Well, and I think that's why we've picked this week, right? Because we're all reminded on April 15th to do our taxes. And we know that the two things that are sure in life are death and taxes. So in the same week that we're thinking about taxes, we're also thinking about our healthcare decisions. So that's why this week is selected. We want to make sure that we're covering all the sureties in life. So making sure you have those documents completed. And Dr. Jessica's right, divorce, it doesn't just cancel the appointment of your ex-spouse. It cancels the entire document. So even if you have ex-spouse as number one and then adult kid as number two, we don't just skip the ex-spouse. The appointment of the adult kid is also canceled. So you need to make sure to get those documents updated, looked at, need to make sure the right boxes are checked, all of that.
Wow, that's a wonderful point that I wouldn't have not have thought of, which brings me to this point, because life changes. So how often is a really good time to just look at it? I mean, every 5 years or so, do you take it out and say, oh my gosh, I don't even talk to that person anymore, I should probably update that? Do you have a kind of a schedule in mind, Sarah?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I usually advise people of the six D's. One of those D's is a decade, although I think a lot of people come in before a decade. I know I've been doing this for a little while, and during that decade, inevitably laws change, kids get older, people, your family circumstances change, people get married, have kids, this lots of changes. So the other D's all involve other life changes, decline in health, different financial circumstances, you know, lots of different things that could happen in your life that would make you want to revisit who you've appointed, if they're still appropriate, if they agree with and will follow through on the wishes that you've communicated. And I think that's one of the main messages we want to get across today, too. Even doing these documents is the most important thing, but also just communicating the wishes that you have about your end of life care, what sort of things that are important to you, so that everybody knows those things and we can actually follow through on what those wishes are.
Because I imagine that could cause a problem in the hospital room, Dr. Jessic, that somebody thinks that they have the power to do something when they actually don't. Have you had problems in that area?
Lots of problems in that area, unfortunately. And it makes a really tough health situation more difficult for family members. Mm-hmm. A lot of assumptions are going on. Hey, I'm those child, I'm the favorite child, so therefore clearly I'm the decision maker, when that hasn't been discussed or set up ahead of time, right? I think part of the problem also is that some folks actually have the documents done, but as Sarah mentioned, if you didn't discuss what your wishes are with your power of attorney, that makes it really, really difficult in those really, really crucial moments, right? Mm-hmm. So getting documents done, letting your power of attorney know that they're your power of attorney, because that comes up too, or they haven't mentioned that to them, are all really, really crucially important. So the conversation and the documentation is just really, really important.
Sure. So Sarah, you don't have to let somebody know that you've chosen them?
They don't have to, but they should.
Yeah, that would be a nice thing to tell somebody.
Yes, definitely. Mm. I often tell people, because usually when I'm helping people, we're doing more of a comprehensive plan that includes power of attorney documents. And I tell people, you know, don't tell people what's going to happen when you're gone, when you're dead. Make sure they know, though, that they're going to make decisions during your life. That is a vital communication point to have with folks. I've always taken the position that you should shout it from the rooftops, that you have your estate planning documents completed, that you have your power of attorney in place. Everybody should know that, because if the more people that know, the more likely we're going to be able to utilize that document and honor your wishes.
Well, I'm thinking there should be parties. You know, there's a party for everything else. Why don't we do a party for that?
I like parties.
Okay, yeah.
Parties are good.
Absolutely. Our guests are Sarah Micheletti, an attorney at McCarty Law LLP in Appleton, and Dr. Tim Jessic, a palliative medicine physician. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org if you have any questions. We'll be right back. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Najel, and coming up at 11:45, we're going to talk about osteoporosis treatment and prevention. But right now, we are talking about advanced healthcare directives, and we do have a caller, Charles in Oshkosh. Go right ahead with your question.
Hi, good program. I have clients execute these documents, and a lot of them say, when are you in a persistent vegetative state or terminal state? That's the terms used in the Wisconsin Living Will. And how do I know that? And will I recover? And what is the doctor, how do they determine that a person is definitely terminal or persistent vegetative state?
Go ahead, Dr. Jessic.
Well, I'll take that. Great, great question. I think that the biggest part of this is that we want patients to have to be empowered to make their own decisions, right? This is their life. They should make their own decisions. So we take this conversation very, very seriously. At what point would we have somebody else make decisions for you? And it's very, very specific, not only legally, but also medically. We're talking about a condition called incapacity. You have to actually have two providers that evaluate a patient and say, boy, at this point, they just can't make decisions for themselves. Now, right away, we don't necessarily say this is going to be a 1 hour time where they can't make their decisions for them, or a 1 year thing, right? All we know is that in this moment, they can't make the best decisions for them because they're so ill, or because they're having such a high fever, or whatever that is. And it's in that moment where you say, hey, we need to ask somebody else to make decisions that can understand what's going on, interpret things, let us know what they want. And in this case, that's when we choose the power of attorney to do that for us. So it's very, very serious. We, on the medical side, will not take that away from a patient lightly, because it's not a light type of decision. And then we wait for a couple of days to see how things go. A lot of times folks will wake up and all of a sudden they'll be nice and alert and they can make decisions, and they shouldn't do that at that point. But it's a very specific process that we medically will take before we activate a power of attorney. And I should also say that, again, even if we activate a power of attorney and ask that power of attorney to make decisions, that's not forever. Again, if the patient's mind clears, great. We want that the patient to make their own decisions at that point.
And Charles,
Great question.
did you have a second question also?
Yeah, as far as I guess the other question was the importance of a HIPAA authorization. How does that fit in with a healthcare power of attorney? And why do you need one of those also?
Okay.
Or should you have one?
Who wants to tackle that one? Sarah?
Sure. So the HIPAA authorization is an additional document that I see often where the person authorizes another person to get their medical records. I don't think a HIPAA authorization would require the same activation as a power of attorney document. So that would just allow my sister to be able to come in and see my medical file, get medical information about me, but not make decisions for me. So the purpose of those documents is different.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for those questions, Charles. We did have a listener email to ask where they can find local help to complete advanced care planning. Sarah, can you help them out with that?
Definitely. So there's lots of resources for folks. Obviously, I'm going to advocate to see an elder law attorney or estate planning attorney to get your documents completed. But if that's not in the cards for you, there are many free resources that are available. I recommend the GWAR folks, the guardianship assistance folks. They have a great resource that's the Greater Wisconsin Agency on Aging Resources. The Guardianship Support Center attorney from GWAR is great, and they have a bunch of resources on their website. There are free resources, free documents, the power of attorney documents, both healthcare, financial, and the living will or declaration to physicians document is also available online. There are some local contacts that are listed in the Wisconsin Medical Society Advanced Care Planning webpage. One of our local resources up in the Fox Valley, we have the Fox Valley Advanced Care Planning Partnership that has a bunch of local resources as well.
Okay, great. Thank you. That's a lot of resources. So much
Yes.
appreciated. Let's go back to the phone. Seth in Wausau, go right ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I make this call as a former ICU nurse who unfortunately had to see this scenario play out quite often in the intensive care unit. And I think one of the big things that's lacking and what we never talk about is actually what does it mean to be a full code versus a DNR on our advance directive paperwork? I don't think that's talked through enough. I think people maybe get nervous and just make the decision without knowing what that actually means for their healthcare. And I've seen too many people at the end of life say, I wish I would have known what this meant for my loved one because they wouldn't have wanted whatever procedure done. And end-of-life care is obviously very invasive and oftentimes very difficult to deal with. So I think just a suggestion would be to really advance information and knowledge about that aspect of advanced directives.
Okay, Seth, Dr. Jessica, could you explain what those acronyms mean, number one, and the difference between them?
Absolutely. And great comments, Seth. And thank you so much for your service in the ICU. It's such a difficult place to work. But when we talk about resuscitation and do not resuscitate, what we're specifically talking about, and this is part of what Seth was bringing up, is folks just don't know what they don't know, or they don't know what that all means. For us as providers, nurses and physicians and otherwise, what we want to know when a patient comes into the hospital specifically is, heaven forbid, their heart stops, they stop breathing, and they die. Do they want Seth and other ICU folks to try to bring them back from the dead by doing chest compressions, by putting a tube down their throat and breathing for them, and shocking the heart to try to bring them back from the dead? Super, super important for us to know how aggressive folks want to get, right? some folks say, well, yeah, try stuff if you can. But if they really understood what was involved with resuscitation and that act and what Seth and his colleagues do all the time, you might think differently. It's really interesting. If you look at the medical studies behind CPR, cardiopulmonary resuscitation, and resuscitation in general, if someone dies in the hospital, there's only a 15% chance, 15% chance that that person will leave the hospital alive. Right? Pretty low chances. Doesn't mean that we shouldn't try this, but it's not that successful. A similar study asked the public, well, if you died in the hospital and needed to be resuscitated, what's the success rate in the hospital? The public's number, they thought 80% of them thought that you can be brought back from the dead, right? So there's already a disconnect as far as what we can do medically and kind of what people think because they've watched ER and all these different shows that are available. But this is one of the discussions. And I think this is where the living will part that Sarah brought up is really, really important. For some people, they say, listen, I lived a good life. I don't want to die. But if my heart stops, my time has come. I want to be with the Lord. I want to be with my spouse. Let me go. Don't bring me back from the dead. And by the way, kids and everybody else, don't even try to bring me back from the dead. Otherwise, I'm going to haunt you. That's up to us, medically wise, and even Sarah, you know, filling out paperwork to clarify that, make sure everyone knows what the patient's wishes are.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Seth. I really appreciate that. So, Sarah, is that something that you clarify when you're talking to people, that they understand exactly what that means?
Yes. So the two documents that I talked about, the power of attorney and the declaration to physicians, doesn't really address DNR, which is do not resuscitate. Do not resuscitate is something the physician will give you a little bracelet for, and that will indicate to first responders or hospital professionals that you do not want to be resuscitated. And that's a conversation you need to have with your physician, your healthcare provider. The documents that I complete with folks appoint someone with authority to make decisions about certain things, like withholding or throwing a feeding tube, admission to long-term care facilities. The declaration to physician talks about if you have are in a persistent vegetative state or have life-altering conditions, whether or not you want feeding tubes or life-sustaining procedures. So that declaration to physician is a what I want. The healthcare power of attorney appoints someone to execute those things. And then the third wrinkle to that scenario is the do not resuscitate bracelet.
Okay, so that the person would make those decisions, have more time to make those decisions and be able to get more facts, whereas the do not resuscitate has to be done in a moment. Dr. Jessic, if you do not have any indication what the patient wants, then I'm assuming that you do need to try to resuscitate, correct?
Absolutely. We assume they want everything done until they tell us otherwise.
Okay. All right. That makes sense.
And one of the messages really that we're trying to get across today is having those power of attorney documents in place, having those conversations in advance will allow us to follow what your wishes are and appoint someone who you trust to make those choices for you. Mm-hmm. If you don't have documents in place, we could potentially be looking for a guardianship or someone that you don't want to make those choices or who doesn't know what your choices are. So having some advanced planning in place allows us to be able to follow your wishes.
Now, that brings up that I believe that there's a new state law that allows for a patient's next of kin to be appointed as their patient representative to make healthcare decisions for them. So how is that then playing out with this topic, Sarah?
Good question. So the governor signed a new law into effect at the end of March, and the moniker for that law has been the next of kin legislation. Now, I think we need to probably make sure that our listeners understand that this doesn't take the place of a power of attorney document. It does not appoint someone to make your healthcare decisions under any circumstance when you're incapacitated. It's very limited in scope. It's very limited for the time period in which that patient representative would be able to make decisions. So I think it's not, well, I don't think it's going to be enough to mean that you don't need advanced care planning. It is not enough. It's not a substitute for a good power of attorney. It's not a substitute for these conversations that you can have with your family and friends. It is not an indication of your wishes. It's not appointing someone you want to make those wishes. It's very limited in the fact that it will appoint perhaps someone in very limited circumstances when someone is incapacitated to move into a long-term care facility and only for a very short period of time. So it is not a comprehensive law that replaces advanced care planning.
Dr. Jessic, what's your point of view on that? Is that going to be helpful? Yes, no, maybe.
I think, and Sarah's the expert at this, but I think it's too soon to tell. I have my concerns as Sarah does, and mm-hmm. I would completely agree this does not replace a good advanced care planning. You want to be able to be in control of your healthcare and who you choose, right? You want to be empowered to be able to do this, and this law doesn't change that at all. So a little bit too soon to tell, but absolutely, we still need good advance directives. We want to come back next year with your Jill and say, hey, it's still really important to be doing this.
Okay. Let's go back to the phone. We have Carol in Lake County, Illinois. Go ahead, Carol.
Yes, thank you. My question relates to payable on death documents, POD documents, which I have for my mortgage, for my home, for my children. And I'm wondering if there's such a thing as a blanket POD, so you don't have to fill out beneficiary forms for bank accounts, CDs, and so on.
I can take that one. Thanks for calling, Carol. So I think one of the main things to distinguish here is that the documents that we're talking about this morning have to do with decisions made during your life. So having power of attorney documents in place will be able to appoint someone to make decisions for you if you're incapacitated or need help during your life. Power of attorney documents die with you. They don't have any effect or any meaning after your death. So when we're talking about payable upon death beneficiary designations or transfer on death beneficiary designations, those are things that apply after you are dead. And I could spend a whole nother hour talking about that particular issue. And the other nuance here, Carol, is that I heard when you called in that you're from Illinois, and states have different laws. We have different mechanisms for how things work upon your death. So I would encourage you to consult with an Illinois attorney about your options with regard to how your assets will transfer upon your death.
Thank you, Carol. And that was something I was going to bring up, too, because it is so different in each state. And I'm assuming it's the same thing for the medical profession, Dr. Jessic, that you've got licensed to practice in Wisconsin, but it's way different in every other state, right?
Absolutely right. You know, we have to follow those laws and those rules. They're for a place. And when it applies to advanced care planning, advanced directives, it applies there as well, right? Mm-hmm. Each state seems to have a little bit different variation based on statute, what's on that document. Mm-hmm. What I would say, though, is if I see somebody from Florida that has a document filled out where they picked somebody, well, maybe that document isn't valid or legal in the state of Wisconsin, but at least it gives me a really good idea who you chose or who I could start with. So
sure.
The legality is a piece of this. The practicality piece is there as well.
So for someone go ahead, Sarah.
No, sorry. I was just going to add that I review a lot of people's powers of attorney when they come in, move to Wisconsin from out of state. And I get a lot of questions, too, about the legality of that paperwork outside of the state of Wisconsin. Now, I can't comment on the latter part, but the first one, when people come to me from with a POA from Florida, for example, I want to make sure that we have the boxes checked. I'm making air quotes here, people, because I want to make sure that in Wisconsin, we have a very specific directive in the statute that says that the agent that you've appointed needs specific authority outlined written in the document that says they have the ability to admit to a nursing home, a community-based residential facility, the authority to withdraw or withhold their feeding tube, and the authority to make decisions while pregnant. So it's very important that when I'm reviewing POAs from out of state, that those certain things are outlined in that document. So You need to make very sure that the right authority is granted in those documents from out of state.
So would you suggest that someone who maybe spends half of their time in another state and in Wisconsin have both, for both states, have documents for both states?
That's a tough one. So yes, but we need to make sure to remain consistent. Also, when you execute a new healthcare power of attorney on this statutory state form in Wisconsin, that power of attorney will revoke other power of attorney documents. So we need to be very careful when we do that and make sure that if you're doing one in Florida and one in Wisconsin, that they're not revoking each other and that we know which one will supersede the other.
Okay. Well, that makes sense, but still confusing. So anyway, last words on this before we have to say goodbye to you, Dr. Jessic.
Again, thank you for this great opportunity. This is so, so important, which is why we bring it up every single year. From the medical side, we want to make sure we provide the right care for the right patient at the right time. And if we don't have these discussions early, we don't know what those decisions are. So filling out documents, appointing folks that can help make decisions for you and having these honest discussions, whether it's at a party or sometimes we jokingly say, well, you have everyone at Thanksgiving, just bring it up at Thanksgiving so everyone knows. So as you said at the very beginning of the show, Jill, this is a gift that we can share with our family members. So please get these done and have these discussions. It doesn't have to be scary. It's normalizing, it's empowering, and it's just a wonderful thing to do for your family members.
Okay, Sarah?
Yes. Thank you, Jill. Thank you, Dr. Jessic. That was great. I agree 100% with everything you said. I think that this topic is so important for every single adult to take care of. Make sure we all know what your wishes are. We don't want to guess. We want to honor your wishes. We have those resources available to everybody at the state bar and through the Greater Wisconsin Agency on Aging. So I would encourage everyone to do your homework and get those documents completed.
Well, thank you both for spending some time with us, your valuable time, and sharing it with our listeners. We really, really appreciate it. So thank you. Dr. Tim Jessic is a doctor of osteopathy and a palliative medicine physician. There we are. Sarah Micheletti is a partner in McCartney Law in Appleton. So thank you both once again. Up next, we're going to talk about osteoporosis. So stay with us. Estimated 10 million Americans age 50 and over have osteoporosis. That's a bone health disease, in case you weren't aware. And 43 million more people in the U.S. have low bone mass, putting them at risk for osteoporosis. And we're going to talk about how it's prevented and treated with our next guest. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Dr. Christina Morganti is a UW health orthopedic surgeon and a faculty member in the Department of Orthopedics and Rehabilitation Medicine at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. And Dr. Morganti specializes in treating bone conditions and sports injuries, like my tongue, apparently. And she's here to help us today understand this and answer your questions. So if you have any about the treatment of osteoporosis, what you can do to prevent it, please join in the conversation by calling 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. So, Dr. Morganti, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
You bet. And you're coming to us live from your treehouse. I love that so much.
Yes, I am. Hopefully you won't hear the geese and the birds out there talking to us. Yes.
Oh, that's just atmosphere. We love that. Yeah. That's no problem whatsoever. So as I'd mentioned, osteoporosis is a bone disease, but why don't you give us the actual technical description of it?
Yeah. Well, if you look at the language, osteo refers to bone and porosis, porous bone. So it really means a thinning or weakening of the bones. And the significance of that is people with osteoporosis are more susceptible to having a fracture, a broken bone. And that's interesting part about it is you might not know you have osteoporosis. It's kind of silent until something bad happens. So that's the whole thing with awareness. Osteoporosis month is coming up, so people know, hey, I better check and make sure my bones are in good shape and try to figure out before something catastrophic happens.
True, true. And it's something that happens as we grow older, right, in general.
Correct.
Why is that? What happens that causes them to start to deteriorate?
Well, interestingly, your bones, as you start as a baby, and you're just a bunch of cartilage, and that starts to calcify as your skeleton develops, and you start to add bone, and you're done adding bone sort of the end of your teens or early 20s. That's all you're going to get. And then in a person with balanced hormones, it stays about stable for about 20, 30 years. And then in women around the menopause transition, you lose estrogen, which is an important hormone for bone. And so particularly women drop off rapidly after menopause. And then with aging itself, there's a gradual decline in bone density, both men and women.
Does it happen with women a little earlier than with men?
It can. It's interesting. The menopause transition is becoming more and more out there and more people talking about it. And it can last about 10 years up to menopause. And then after, traditionally, the thought is after 49, 50, when people have menopause, you lose about a couple percentage points a year. And then men too, after 50.
Okay.
But women have this lead up going up to it that they may lose bone even earlier than when you actually know you're in menopause.
I see. So should people start getting tested at a certain time to see if their bone loss is maybe worse than others?
Yeah, I think, the recommendation is that all women 65 and over should have a bone density test, and men 70 and over should have a bone density test. However, if you have a risk factor for osteoporosis, particularly women, I'm going to turn off my ringer here. You should
that
have
was not
one
a goose,
earlier.
Just so you know.
It's not a goose, it's a ringer. Yeah. So women, if you have a family history, if you had early menopause, if you have had a fracture, a low energy fracture, that would indicate you should get checked even before that 65 year old age.
Okay. But otherwise, it's 65. That's probably why I was told to get one this year. So it's an interesting process. It doesn't hurt. You get to lie down. It's kind of relaxing. Just super simple. Do you recommend that people get it? And when they do get it, what does it tell you?
So it tells you your bone density, which is one factor that describes how strong your bones are. Mm-hmm. So it's the most common way to assess your bone strength. And it actually gives you a measurement, how much mineral they detect in the bone. And typically they measure your hip bone density, both hips and different areas of the hip. There's a part of it called the femoral neck, and then there's the total hip. And they also typically measure your spine, four levels of the spine, L1 through L4. And sometimes they measure your forearm. And then they take this number, this is how much mineral we detected, and they try to make sense of it by comparing it to a reference population. And then they describe that comparison by a T-score, which is actually the standard deviation, what your actual numbers are from this reference population. So if you're within one standard deviation, which is T-score plus 1 to minus 1, that's considered normal. Mm-hmm. If you're more than 2.5 standard deviations below normal, minus 2.5 or lower T-score, then that's considered osteoporosis. And then there's this in between, you're not normal, you're not osteoporosis. So they gave it a name and they call it osteopenia. And people with osteopenia can still break a bone. In fact, because more people are in that category, osteopenia around the world, there are actually more fractures, people with osteopenia than osteoporosis, but your risk of fracture is higher if your numbers are lower.
Okay.
And then if you're younger, then if you're premenopausal woman or younger than 50 as a man, this comparison number isn't the T-score they use. It's called the Z-score. And that actually compares you to people your own age. And okay. So for a younger person, if you're more than 2 standard deviations below the reference, it's considered low bone density for age. So Z-score minus 2.0 or lower.
So when women go into menopause, is it a good idea to do hormone replacement therapy? Does that help with the loss of bone density?
It does help with the loss of bone density. And it's interesting that you bring that up, because I don't know if you followed the past couple of decades. First it was in, then it was out, and now it's back in again. So, reviewing the data, every decision you make for your health is weighing the risks versus the benefits. And it appears upon re-review of the data, the risks are lower than one would have thought, and more women are opting for it, not particularly specifically for bone density, although some women decide that way, but for menopausal symptoms. And before November of last year, when the FDA removed their black box warning, we used to say, hey, if you happen to be on hormone replacement for menopausal symptoms, it's going to help your bone density, but we didn't typically prescribe it just for that. But now that the black box warning has been removed and people are educating themselves more, there are some women are choosing it for general health.
Would the amount that's prescribed, the dosage, matter if you have osteoporosis or not?
Yeah, typically it's a decision you make with your doctor or your gynecologist, the dose. But most women are on about the same dose for the menopausal symptoms, which was protective for bone.
Okay. Well, that's good. Mm-hmm. Now, what about younger people? Are there things that they should be concerned about when you're young? I mean, we've always heard drink your milk. It helps to be in Wisconsin, too. But are those kind of things preventative? Have that been proven, or is that just hearsay?
No, for sure. Because like we mentioned, this your bone formation phase, so only into your late teens, early 20s, that is your chance to build as much bone as you can. Mm-hmm. And if you have unhealthy habits during that time, then you might not reach your optimal peak bone mass, right? So you want to do everything you can to do the best you can to build your skeleton to a healthy skeleton. And there are a lot of things you can do. So one is nutrition. So having enough calcium and vitamin D coming in, particularly for athletes or kids who might have eating disorders, enough calories coming in so you could still build the bone the way you're supposed to, enough protein, enough exercise, weight-bearing exercise. And that's been an issue with more electronics and more sedentary lifestyle of the kids. Also, kids who are this idea of sports specialization. So at an early age, you choose one sport. So you're doing the same repetitive motions over and over. For example, a kid chooses running, just goes in a straight line. Then they lack the differential load bearing in different directions that affects the geometry of the bone. So there's a new movement to remind kids to do multi-directional sports, varied sports, so your bones don't develop for just one thing. So you can do many things, and then you'll have not only denser bones, but a better geometry bones.
So that'll make your bones stronger as you get older, but does it also keep them stronger when you're younger, too, so you're less likely to have a break?
Yeah. Theoretically. Well, kids, I will say kids don't usually get the osteoporosis-type fractures. Usually it's a traumatic-type thing.
Sure.
Some kids get overuse injuries, particularly these kids doing lots of sports and not eating well enough, mm-hmm. or having training errors or equipment errors. So that does help them, mm-hmm. for sure.
But definitely drink your milk.
Drink your milk, right. And I'd also say if these benefits last into adulthood. So, for example, actually Dr. Schipeller, chairman at Wisconsin, and I did a study years ago where we looked at gymnasts, and then she followed them for decades into adulthood. And the kids who had better bone density as children still had it into adulthood. So you're creating your bone geometry and your bone substrate then. So you have a better reservoir. So when you start to lose later, you're in better shape.
Well, that makes a whole lot of sense. But can we, if we start taking supplements and things as we're older, is that going to make a difference? Is it going to make the bone loss? We're not going to gain more, but is it going to make it less? Is it going to slow it down, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, so that is like a very complicated question.
Oh, great.
So,
right before we have to break for news.
Okay, you tell me. Yeah.
We can save it for after that for sure. I tell you what, let's do that. Yeah. Let's save it for afterwards. We are talking with Dr. Christina Morganti. She's a UW Health orthopedic surgeon and a faculty member in the Department of Orthopedics and Rehabilitation Medicine at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. And we'll be back with her. But we'd love to hear your questions and comments, so give us a call, 800-642-1234. We'll be back right after the news with more. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. I'm sitting in for Larry today, and we're talking about osteoporosis with Dr. Christina Morganti. She is a UW Health orthopedic surgeon and faculty member in the Department of Orthopedics and Rehabilitation Medicine at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. And all of our lines are filled right now. We've got a couple of emails to get to, so we'll get right to it. And as we left, we were talking about supplements, etc. As it happens, we do have some calls about that. So let's take that first before we get into some things that maybe we didn't cover. So let's go to Barbara in Glenwood, Iowa. Go ahead, Barbara.
Thank you for doing this program. And please tell Larry, I hope he feels better soon.
Oh, he's probably listening, but I will be happy to forward that on to him.
Thank you. I'm 79 and my husband is 80, and we both had mothers with osteoporosis, so I've been followed out. So I have osteopenia. He is taking, and he is getting monthly infusions now from a neurologist for relating to mitochondrial breakdown, and that doctor is very concerned about the development of osteoporosis. But so they all want us to take supplements, but I get confused when I go to my favorite drugstore and try to get a buy one, get one free product, and it says there's a calcium that's 600 milligrams, one just 500, one with D3, one without D3. So it's all very confusing to me. How much, what should we take and how much should we take specifically?
I don't think she's alone in that, Dr. Morganti.
Yeah, I think this might be a long answer, so I'm sorry.
But, that's okay. We have a half an hour.
Okay, perfect. Because this goes back to the question that Jill asked me, because you asked me, will supplements help decrease the risk of fracture? And there's a difference between that and is overall nutrition going to help? And the thinking is that having enough, particularly calcium and vitamin D, is important for bone health and will help. However, the thinking is that all the research studies that are so conflicting, and some say take this much and that much, and recently they changed the recommendations, they reduced it down, and they said some people should and some shouldn't because the research is conflicting. So some research studies have shown it helps with reducing fracture and improving bone density, and some have not. And some of that may be because the thinking is that, say, you already don't have enough calcium or vitamin D, then supplementing that or having enough in your diet is going to help. It's going to get you to what you need. But say you already have enough and you take more, well, that's not maybe going to make that much of a difference. So when they do a study of people, they don't know where they started. Sometimes it kind of drowns out the difference. But the thinking is that absolutely, the answer is yes, adequate nutrition is important. And the question really is, well, how much is adequate? And based on these recommendations, they keep changing, and how do you get it? And the recommendation is typically to get it from food if you can, except for vitamin D is difficult to get from food. So many people need a supplement. But currently, the recommendation is for people with risk of bone health, like you and your husband are, that may need a supplement. And there are two ways you can make a recommendation. One way is to make a blanket population recommendation, like they just did. And they just said everyone should have 600 units of vitamin D a day. International units is how they're out there. And if you're over 70, you should have 800 international units. So that's one way to do it. And that still is conflicting because patients are different and some people have risk and some people take vitamin D and some people have sunlight and some people wear sunscreen. It's confusing. The other way to make a recommendation is making an individual recommendation from your doctor after they check a blood level to see what your actual blood level of vitamin D is and then see if you lie in the recommended level and recommend your supplements based on that. So if you have a high risk for bone health, it's good to talk to your doctor and get a level and see do you need more than you're already getting from your typical food that you're getting and sunlight, and then supplement from there if needed. Other nutrients, not vitamin D, like calcium and other nutrients are easier to get from food. And if you can get it from your food sources, that's preferred. But if you can, a supplement is just fine. Mm-hmm. And so the other issue with supplements is that it's not that well regulated like drugs are. So it's hard to know exactly what you're getting in the pill. And so normally I tell patients there's sometimes a little ribbon on there, blue ribbon that says it's been reviewed by the RDA. So that is a reputable source. And then if you want to follow the population-based recommendations to start with, someone your age and your husband should start with 800 international units a day. And then I might talk to his doctor specifically about measuring a blood level. It's a vitamin D25OH level, and they can tell you, hey, where does my vitamin D store level live, and should I have more?
Okay, great. Well, that didn't take a half hour, so I think you did really, really well,
doctor. Okay, good.
Thank you, Barbara. Good luck with that, because I agree with you. It is confusing. Let's go to Pat in Green Bay. She has something to say about vitamin D, too. Go ahead, Pat.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for doing the show, and I want to chime right in on what you just said about vitamin D. My own story, my bone health is fine, but we just I requested a vitamin D level from my physician, because my primary care physician, because it's not normally part of your blood work when you go in for a physical, although I've read in the literature that it ought to be, that more than half the population of the United States in age 60 or higher is deficient in vitamin D levels in our bodies. And I was found deficient. I was only at level 26, and I think 50 is the normal circulating vitamin D level you're supposed to be at. And so I'm taking 5,000 units, 5,000 IUs a day, supplemented with K2. And I hope you can talk a little bit about K2 also as a boost for vitamin D3, because I was told that your body needs to direct your vitamin D to your bones, not your heart. So K2 is kind of crucial there. And my husband, I requested his vitamin D to be checked after he had knee surgery, and it took him a long time to recover from, it was knee replacement. But nobody thinks to check vitamin D levels before such a surgery. I think that's odd. His D level was zero. It was tanked. It was, so no wonder he was suffering.
Wow.
So thanks. Thanks for doing this.
Okay, thank you, Pat. Wow. Can you, vitamin D zero? I mean, my gosh, how does that even happen? So what was your reaction to that?
Well, I have so many things to say about that, actually. First of all, if you're deficient in vitamin D, I don't know if you remember hearing about like the kids in England back in the war that had rickets, or with Industrial Revolution, with the smoke from that, the blocking out the sun, they had rickets. And that's what the vitamin D insufficiency is. And it could be rickets, and that could be painful, actually. So sometimes your vitamin D level is so low, it's a source of pain. So it's good to check it. The recommendations that just came out, which are confusing, I think, is that vitamin D, they just said that you shouldn't screen for vitamin D in the population because it hasn't been shown to definitively help change health for many things that it's been claimed for, like immunology and cancer and things like that, except for bone health. So if you have risk of bone health, you should check your vitamin D. They recently said someone over 75, but I think it's a good idea to get it checked. And then if you were to start supplementing, it takes about 3 months for the level to equilibrate to see if you got the right dose. So after starting it, 3 months later, maybe check another one to see if you got up too much or too little and if you hit your target. The actual range of normal is between 30 and 80 currently. That's what it is. So we usually aim for the middle, like between 40 and 60, usually around 40. But if you're over 30, it's considered sufficient. So a level of 26 wasn't too bad, but I think it's a good idea to get your level up a little higher will help you. Vitamin K, I think you talked about that one. There is not as much extensive research on vitamin K as calcium and vitamin D. However, it is important in making the collagen for bone, and there's a thought that it may help the whole process because you have to make the collagen the substrate, then you have to mineralize it, which is what vitamin D helps get that calcium there. So it may help. And you just have to be careful about the consequences. So for example, vitamin A, vitamin D, vitamin E, vitamin K, they're all fat soluble vitamins. So those get stored in sometimes vitamin A and vitamin D, for example, can compete for receptors. So you might, if you took more A, you might not be able to bind the vitamin D as well. But I think many practitioners think having a vitamin D with a K in the same supplement is a good idea, but it just hasn't been as strongly supported. There's just not as much out there as there is for calcium and vitamin D.
Okay, great. Thank you very much, Pat. We appreciate that. Pilar in Madison emailed to say that she is 56 and in early menopause, and she has been told that bone density testing will not be covered by her insurance until age 65, but she wants to know how her bones are doing now as she weighs the risks and benefits of starting menopause hormone therapy. Do you have advice on where to get testing and what type of test to ask for? And if she needs to, you know, if she needs to get it outside of insurance.
Yeah, well, part of it depends on your insurance. So Medicare covers it for women 65 and over. And many of the insurances do cover a DEXA scan or bone density scan, same kind of name. If you have a risk factor for osteoporosis and are younger than 65. So, for example, you're a woman postmenopausal, that's a risk factor. So most insurances would typically cover it, and you'd ask for a DEXA scan or bone density test. I would say if for some reason it wasn't covered, to be honest, it's not that expensive of a test. Sometimes it's less than $100, not that much more than an x-ray. But someone who's 56 typically, or if you had any risk, a family history or a Caucasian woman, or you, they probably would be covered.
Okay. So just call.
Yeah.
Sometimes that helps. That helps. Janice in Appleton, let's go to you next. Go right ahead.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. Excellent program. I am a 66-year-old, very active woman. I lift weights twice a week. I practice yoga 5 days a week. I do biking, walking, gardening, very, very active. I've recently been diagnosed with osteopenia, and I am taking 2,000 milligrams of vitamin D daily. I'm just wondering what else I can do to reduce my risk of getting osteoporosis.
Preventative.
Yeah. They're doing a really great job, so I congratulate you on that. And I understand your reason for wanting to prevent osteoporosis because you're active, you have an active lifestyle, you don't want to be sidelined by fractures or loss of function. And a lot of women who think about this and this idea of, they call it successful aging, not usual aging, but successful aging, and you're sort of on your way to that. So the cornerstone of maintaining your bone health are really five things. One is nutrition. So getting enough calcium, preferably from food, having adequate vitamin D intake, enough calories coming for an active person, having enough calories and protein coming in. And so an active person sometimes needs to be on the higher end of the recommendations. And, our Secretary of Health, Mr. Kennedy, increased the protein intake. So now it's up to about over 1.5 milligrams per kilogram a day. So enough calcium, enough vitamin D, enough proteins, enough calorie nutrition-wise, and then enough weight-bearing exercise, which you are terrific. And then avoiding poison, they say. So, for example, smoking. No, not good. And then alcohol, they used to recommend no more than 2 drinks a day. But to be honest, now it's the less you have, the better, because that's kind of poisonous to the bones. And then sometimes there are medications you are on or have to be on. Like, for example, if someone had to be on prednisone or some of those medications, a big one is PPIs for antacids. If you had a way to get off those, if you have to be on them, fine. But if you had a way to substitute or get on something else, that would help preserve your bones. And then the last two things is, one, making sure you don't have a secondary cause of osteoporosis. So, for example, if you didn't know you had celiac disease and you weren't absorbing your nutrients well, or if you were low in vitamin D and if you had something correctable. And every time we see a patient that we're evaluating for osteoporosis or they've had a fracture and we're worried, hey, why did this happen? We always look for the common things that could cause it. If you haven't had a fracture and you have osteopenia, you probably don't need an extensive blood test, but a vitamin D level would be good and a dietary review. And then the last thing is medication. And typically that is reserved for people at higher risk for fracture, someone who's already had a fracture or has low scores or a family history or a lot of medical problems. There is now a school of thought that's developing since the recent recommendations on postmenopausal care, and some women are interested in prevention. And there are preventive doses of medications if you chose to take one of those. So, for example, Fosamax, the famous one, you know, when it came out, it was a 10 milligram a day dose, and they changed it to a once a week 70 milligrams. But there's also a half dose, and that used to be prescribed for prevention. It kind of went away a little bit, the prevention thoughts, because we were so concerned with the very serious highest risk people. But now people are more concerned about the successful aging. And if they wanted to consider that, it's something you could talk about with your doctor.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for that call, Janice. Let's go to Lisa in Madison.
Hi there. Thanks a lot for having this program. It's very timely for me. I'm a 77-year-old woman. I've had osteoporosis since 1993, so for 33 years. I was on HRT for 10 years, then on Fosamax, Forteo, Avista. In 2018, I started the annual injection infusions of Reclast, and I took that for 5 years with a one-year holiday in between. I have fractures, compression fractures at T4, 5, 6, 7, and 8. I have just recently had a two-year holiday from the Avista. So I had heard that you should not take, Reclast, that you should not take Reclast for more than 5 years. So that's one question. Would that be a good thing to go back on the Reclast?
Yeah, so that's a great question. It sounds like your doctor's really been watching you very carefully over the years, and you've had a lot of help for your bones. The Reclast is one of the bisphosphonates, so the same class of drugs as Fosamax, Boniva, Lendronate, those. And so the risk with those that people worry about that have made the recommendations to limit the use of it are the possibility of an atypical femur fracture and osteonecrosis of the jaw. And that is where the atypical femur fracture is where your hip breaks in a little bit unusual location than typical, and sometimes they're slow to heal. And the thinking is if they've been noticed to people on Reclast or Fosamax for more 7 years or longer. And so for that reason, the recommendation was to take these drug holidays. And the only medications that really are, you're able to do a drug holiday and not risk the loss of the benefit of it, are these bisphosphonates, because they bind to the bone, they stay and they protect it, and they slowly dissipate. So there's not an abrupt loss of it when you stop taking it. So typically for Reclast, you would take it in series, for example, 3 years and take a holiday and maybe go back on if your numbers say you should. So it's not 7 years total in your life, but it's 7 years sort of consecutively. So it sounds like your doctor's watching you, and if you had 3 years and then a break and then back on again and now a break, it might be time to talk about having it again if you're high risk.
Okay. Well, Lisa, thank you. And wow, that's amazing. Sounds painful with all those fractures. Is that kind of typical, or is that an atypical result of person with osteoporosis with the spinal fractures?
Well, you know, what I didn't ask is if those fractures occurred while on therapy or before the therapy started. That was okay. Not, I should have asked.
Lisa, yeah. Are you still there?
I sure am.
Yeah. When did those fractures happen?
Over time.
So over while...
Over time. In 05, I had the... Well, I had 4, 5, 6, and 7, so since 2005.
So while on medication, yeah.
So once you've had one compression fracture, the risk of a second one is much higher. One, because you've been identified as a risk for fracture, you know, so the weeks are obviously weak because you broke them. And then the biomechanics change. So a compression fracture to spine, it's typically a rectangular bone, and it kind of compresses in the front so it looks more like a wedge or a piece of pie. So then the levels above and below who haven't fractured yet also have more force on the front there. And so that's how you can get sequential fractures. And the taking a therapy like a reclass or the others improve bone density, but they decrease the risk of another fracture by about 50%. So they don't make you bionic, but they decrease the risk. And it sounds like if over the past 30 years you had, what, 5 fractures. It's hard to say exactly how it timed with the therapy, but I'm thinking your therapy is helping you. It could have been worse.
Yeah. Okay. Well, like I said, Lisa, thank you for the call, and it sounds like your doctor definitely knows what they're doing. So thanks for sharing that. Let's just take a email before we have to say goodbye. Gail in Madison emailed to say that they have estrogen positive breast cancer. So she's leery of hormone supplementation. Gail's, however, taking bisulfosphate. Can you discuss whether collagen peptides are useful?
I'm sorry, could you say that one more time?
Okay. So she has estrogen positive breast cancer, so she's leery of hormone supplementation. She is taking bisulfosphate. Mm-hmm. Okay. Can you discuss whether collagen peptides are useful?
Okay. Yeah, bisphosphonate are the drugs we were just talking about, reclass and bisphosphonate. And yet, as someone with estrogen-positive breast cancer, you wouldn't be the candidate for hormone replacement typically. I really can't. The peptides and the collagen are sort of new and coming out there, and there's all kinds of claims that they do a lot of things, and I don't think the research is strong enough on bone to tell you that way. Maybe.
Okay. Yep.
Stay tuned.
Stay tuned. Yeah, that's a problem with new drugs. You just never know, right? So, Dr. Organti, you have shared so much information with us. We really, really appreciate it. Calls we didn't get to, and I apologize. So we definitely will try to get you back on again.
Okay.
It's obviously a topic that people are concerned about, and we appreciate you sharing your time with us today. Thank you.
No problem. Yep. Thank you for having me.
You bet. Dr. Christina Morganti is a UW Health orthopedic surgeon and faculty member in the Department of Orthopedics and Rehabilitation Medicine at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. And up next, we're going to talk to the danger of contracting blastomycosis outdoors with Dr. Bruce Klein. So stay with us for that. Blastomycosis is a potentially deadly infection that can result from inhaling a fungus that lives in disturbed dirt, and it's present in part of Wisconsin. Oh, hi, I'm Jill Nijo. One more thing to worry about, and this is the Larry Mueller Show. We're learning more about blastomycosis, also called blasto, from our guest, Bruce Klein. He's a professor of medical microbiology and immunology at UW-Madison. Madison. He oversees the Klein Laboratory, which focuses on fungal pathogenesis and immunology. Why can't I say that, Bruce? Why is that? Why can't I say that?
I don't know. It's probably easier to say that I'm also professor of pediatrics and medicine.
Okay, that sounds good. We can do that. What questions do you have about this disease? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Bruce, thanks you so much for being here. I should say Dr. Klein, but since we're talking about blasto, maybe Bruce is okay?
Bruce is fine.
Okay, thank you very much. So tell us, what is this?
So blastomycosis is a disease that derives from a fungus that lives in the environment, mm-hmm. typically soil or soil-like substrates. This is a fungus that has some unique features in terms of its lifestyle. It grows as a mold in the environment, as a what experts might call a soil saprophyte. It feeds off nutrients in the environment in a mold form. Mm-hmm. When the soil or soil substrate is disturbed, the organism can be inhaled into the lungs, which is the natural route of infection. And because of the change in the environment, typically the increase in temperature from ambient temperature to the temperature within a mammalian host, the organism, as a response to stress, undergoes a dramatic morphological change in its shape. It grows from a spore into a yeast, a large, thick-walled, armored yeast that helps endow it with pathogenic properties so it can survive within the lung environment, and also resist immune defenses by mammalian hosts.
Oh,
so
goodness.
It's a very effective pathogen.
Yeah, it sounds like something like a science fiction movie from the 50s. My goodness. I grew up in the UP, up in the northern part of the world here, and I had never heard of it before, maybe 10 years ago. Is this something that that's fairly new that we've recognized, or has it just been around and we just haven't heard about it?
I think you probably haven't heard about it.
Okay.
It was initially discovered in the late 1900s by an investigator at Johns Hopkins who's credited with this, Gilchrist, who identified the organism in a dog. And so we've known about it for well over a century.
Mm-hmm.
I would say it's a relatively uncommon infection. However, just as the snow flies in Wisconsin and Michigan, we do see outbreaks every year or two, sometimes large, sometimes small. If you're in the Upper Peninsula, mm-hmm. you've probably heard about the outbreak a few years ago in Escanaba, which involved more than 100 people.
Right.
So it's a very large one, yeah. The largest one on record.
Right. And how did that, where did that come from? It's soil-borne, correct?
Generally speaking, it is, although... it's often difficult to know where the organism originated in a large outbreak. More times than not, in fact, almost always, when there's a so-called point source outbreak where everyone's exposed at the same location, experts rush to the site to try and figure out where it originated, to answer the question you asked. And 99 times out of 100, they can't find it. We've been successful in Wisconsin in a few instances that have helped clarify the ecological niche of the fungus. But as in Escanaba, where they searched and collect all kinds of samples from the environment, from HEPA filters inside, outside, from riverbanks, they came up empty-handed, unfortunately. And so they could only speculate where the origin was for that fungus.
So when I was doing a little background on this, I didn't realize that it takes a long time for this to actually, it's like 3 to 12 weeks after exposure for this to become a problem.
It can take a while. Mm-hmm. It probably depends a lot on the number of spores that are inhaled, the so-called inoculum mm-hmm. effect.
Okay.
It probably depends on the individual. Some individuals may be more prone depending on their immune system, depending on their genetic makeup. We had the occasion to investigate a large outbreak in central Wisconsin a number of years ago, perhaps about 10 years ago, and we observed an unusual predisposition or overrepresentation of cases in the Hmong population. And after an extensive investigation of these individuals, we identified a genetic predisposition, a particular gene that rendered them more susceptible. So there are a number of factors that may have to do with the organism, its virulence, the dose inhaled, the host. This all may feed into why it may take shorter or longer to develop symptoms.
Is this something that's contagious from one person to another?
It's a really important question. I'm glad you asked. There's a good deal of misunderstanding, fear, and anxiety when someone contracts this infection, that it could be contagious. But it is not, and I would underscore that point, it is not contagious from one person to another. And the reason for that is that the infectious form of the organism is the spore. The spore is very small and believed to be small enough to be inhaled into the airways. And when it infects an individual, as I mentioned before, it usually changes into a much larger yeast form. And it's believed that those large yeasts are too large to be inhaled and transmitted to another individual. Now, there are some rare, exceedingly rare exceptions. For example, this infection is probably more common in animals, particularly dogs, because they have their nose close to the ground. And in some parts of the state of Wisconsin where this disease has very high rates, and probably the highest in the world, the rate of infection in dogs may be as high as 1 to 2% of the population of animals, and probably 10 to 100 times higher than the rate of infection in people. Dogs that get infected, if they were to be shedding the organism in their saliva and directly inoculated into the hands of a vet, for example, with a bite, that could create what might be called a cutaneous inoculation, an inoculation directly into the skin. Or if somebody is, for example, using a hypodermic needle to aspirate an infection in the skin of an animal and then accidentally stabs themselves or nicks themselves through the skin, that can be a source of direct introduction through the skin, an unnatural route, an uncommon, but occasionally it can happen.
Okay. So with people, what kind of symptoms are we looking at?
Right. So in people who are symptomatic, not everybody is symptomatic.
Okay.
But in individuals who develop symptoms, the most common symptoms are a respiratory infection. So you might not be able to distinguish it from a bad chest cold, for example. This infection, should it get down into your chest and continue to progress, will cause pneumonia. And so one can become sicker with quite a bit of coughing. In an acute form, there can be a high temperature and shaking chills. So I guess the bottom line is it can be hard to distinguish this infection from other causes of pneumonia and a really bad chest cold. So that's in an acute form. We often see probably a higher proportion of cases that are more chronic infections, a so-called walking pneumonia, if you will. And in those cases, you can see it go on for weeks, sometimes even months. People will have periodic temperature. They'll have a cold, but it may be a walking pneumonia. They may lose weight. Sometimes people can lose 10 to 20 pounds with this kind of a walking pneumonia. And so the most important thing is that physicians who see patients like this need to have a high index of suspicion or concern, because it's a less common form of pneumonia.
And this is more likely to be found in the northern part of this of our state, number one, and in what, in the woods, basically. Is that right? Or is it just not necessarily the woods?
You know, people who get out into the woods are going to be exposed to soil that may be contaminated with the fungus. You know, we found through studies years ago with the Wisconsin Division of Health that the organism seems to like moist, rich soil that one can find along riverbanks and riverways. And so it's not uncommon, and there have been famous outbreaks of infection along Wisconsin waterways. For example, the Nemecogon River, the Little Wolf River, the Plover River, the Eagle River chain of lakes. And so, you know, exposure along riverbanks, fishing, canoeing, boating, all these kinds of activities that Wisconsinites and even folks from other nearby states seem to enjoy are potential risk factors. But I would underscore it's an uncommon infection.
It is uncommon, but it's out there, so you should be aware of it.
It is out there.
We are talking about blastomycosis with Bruce Klein, a professor of medical microbiology and immunology at UW-Madison. He oversees the Klein Laboratory and focuses on fungal pathogenesis and immunology. And you can join the conversation. Just give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Elna Joe, tomorrow on the show, we're going to take a look at a new documentary about the Bay of Green Bay. We're going to chat about insects with Phil Pelletieri. And then finally, we're going to talk turkey about the spring turkey hunt. Hopefully you can join us. Right now, we are talking about blasto. And we've got a bunch of calls coming in, so we'll get to those as soon as we can. But right now, we're talking with Bruce Klein. Bruce, we had mentioned about people getting the disease, but we'd also mentioned about dogs getting the disease. Now, that can be a little bit more deadly, should I say, for dogs. Am I right in that?
You're correct. Mm-hmm. The fatality rate in dogs is considerably higher than it is in people. In people who are otherwise healthy, the cure rates are very, very high, better than 90% in people who are treated, diagnosed and treated correctly. In dogs, for various reasons, the fatality rate may approach 50%. And that probably has to do with difficulties in diagnosis in dogs. So the infection is usually progressed to a more invasive state that may have spread from outside the lung, from within the lungs to outside the lungs to other body parts. It may also have to do with considerable cost of care. It can cost thousands of dollars to treat a dog with this infection. And so people may not have insurance and may choose to forego treatment. So there are various reasons for why dogs have a higher fatality rate, unfortunately.
Yeah. Speaking of treatment, we've got Lee and Phillips with a question about that. Go ahead, Lee.
Yeah, I was wondering what the best way to treat blastomycosis is.
Hi, Lee. There's a very effective treatment for blastomycosis in its usual form, that is pneumonia in a previously healthy individual who has mild to moderate infection that's restricted to the lung. There's an oral medication, an oral antifungal medication that's commonly used to treat fungal infections, and it's very effective, usually much better than 90% effective for treating such cases. So the treatment just has to be continued for a while, typically for at least 6 months, which is a longer course of antibiotic, we'll say, than people are usually used to taking. But under those circumstances, the cure rates are very high.
How's it tested for?
Yeah, that can be a challenge. So as I mentioned, the most important way to diagnose this is to have a very high index of suspicion for physicians around the state. And fortunately, doctors around the state are very knowledgeable about this and do think of it. And the Division of Health has done a great job in educating the public. But nevertheless, it can be a challenging diagnosis to make. If someone has pneumonia or a really bad chest cold, you can often find the organism within the expectorated sputum. So when people are sick, they're often coughing, and that material is often positive for the fungus. It can be cultured. It can also be seen under the microscope quite often. There are blood tests that can also be done, looking for antibody, evidence that the immune system has responded to the fungus. And then there are newer tests called antigen tests, where the fungus sheds some of its sort of cell wall, if you will, and those products get into the bloodstream and they get shed into the urine. They get cleared within the urine. And the urine sample usually yields a positive result within about 75% to 90%+ of the time, depending on the form and progression of the illness. Those tests together, the expectorated sputum and the urine and the blood, are often used in combination, and they're frequently positive. So one can diagnose it if one thinks about it.
Once you're looking for it, you're good. And then once treated, is there any lasting effects?
The lasting effects, depending on the form, can be significant. So, for example, if somebody has a very severe and progressive infection in the lungs, we can see this in some instances. There can be long-term damage within the lung, and those are the most severe cases. Sometimes, as I mentioned, the infection can spread outside the lungs, so including, in rare instances, to the brain. And so there can be injury to different parts of the brain and neurologic sequelae as a result. Blastomycosis effectively can spread to any organ in the body if it progresses undiagnosed. And so there can be consequences depending on the organ. But, you know, those are fortunately less frequent complications.
Well, let's go to Scott in Wausau, who may be able to comment on that. Go ahead, Scott.
Hi. Interesting topic. I'm a blastomycosis survivor. I had blasto about 16 years ago, and I lived in a subdivision in the Wausau area at that time that was under heavy construction. And I think just from the disturbance of the soil, which is very sandy and acidic, that must have been where the spores came from, because my neighbor's dog, who never left the yard, also had blastomycosis at that time. It's pretty devastating. I was out of work for a month, and that was categorized at the time as a very mild case of blastomycosis. And I know several others in the neighborhood also had blasto. So fortunately, although misdiagnosed as pneumonia, a heightened awareness by the staff at the hospitals helped with the diagnosis.
Okay, thank you, Scott. Appreciate you sharing that with us. There again, it's kind of prime area of Wisconsin, in that area.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you got over it. That's great news. One of the really unusual and interesting features, about blastomycosis is dogs can often be a harbinger of disease in individuals that are in the same area. So sometimes, you know, if you take a careful history, for example, people that may vacation up north who present to their doctor with a bad chest cold or pneumonia may report to an astute physician who asks the right questions, have you ever had any animals in the home contract a bad infection and die, perhaps? And families may say, oh, yes, we did have a dog that died of blastomycosis. And that's an immediate tip-off that you may be dealing with something like that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Scott. So what should we be thinking about as a precaution with knowing that this is about? Are there things that we should be avoiding or that we can do?
Sure. Well, I would encourage people to enjoy the state of Wisconsin and everything that it has to offer because it's an uncommon infection. If you're healthy, if for some reason you have compromised immunity, you may be more vulnerable mm-hmm. to these kinds of infections. And so I think, you know, avoiding risk factors, I would encourage people to talk with their primary physician about what kinds of things might pose risk. Hunting, fishing, boating, you know, being close to construction. And if one enjoys those activities and chooses to participate, taking appropriate precautions, for example, a mask, a good mask. For example, if the individual has compromised immunity, but nevertheless, you know, wants to participate, I would say an N95 mask that could filter out particulates. Those would be the most important things. And as I say, the other thing is to have a high index of concern. If you're participating in activities like that, and you get sick three to 12 weeks later, and you have a bad chest cold or pneumonia, and your doctor has treated you with one or two or three courses of antibiotics and you're not getting better, you might suggest, well, what about this less common infection due to a fungus?
Mm-hmm. Heidi in Eagle River emailed to say that she's very familiar with Blasto in Eagle River, Wisconsin. People believe that the closer you are to the Wisconsin River, the greater the chances of finding Blasto. She has known people who've had it and survived. However, if a dog gets it, chances of survival appears to decrease. She never lets her dogs dig in the dirt. And when she works with dirt, wood chips, gardening, etc., she always wears a mask. And William emailed to say that he spends summers canoeing on the Red River near the Little Wolf, right in the heart of Blasto country, and he asked, would wearing an N95 mask help? So I think we just said that it probably would.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Another listener called but couldn't stay with us, and he asked if there are higher concentrations of this fungus in or near beaver dams. That's an interesting question.
Right. When I first came to Wisconsin, I was stationed here to work at the Division of Health. And shortly after I arrived, they asked me to establish a program looking at distribution of the infection, rates of the infection, and to become the local expert within the division. And late in that interval, we had the unusual occurrence of a very large outbreak, the largest outbreak on record in Wisconsin at that point in time, of close to 60 cases. And what happened was there were numerous calls coming in sequentially to the Division of Health about young children from different parts of the state who were falling ill with this somewhat uncommon infection. And they asked me to explore it, and quickly we learned it was blastomycosis. And after an extensive investigation promulgated by the Wisconsin Division of Health, really the outstanding Wisconsin Division of Health, who had then invited the CDC in to help investigate the epidemic. Together, we learned that individuals had traveled to Eagle River to learn about the environment. Various school groups from all over the state had gone there to a very famous camp where kids learn about the environment. And they had introduced a new activity, a really exciting new activity, learning about beaver ecology.
Oh, no.
And so you can imagine young children traipsing around and on to a beaver dam. And fifth and sixth graders all jumping up and down, yelling and screaming and throwing dirt. And sure enough, 3 to 12 weeks after that exposure, they began to fall ill. In that instance, we had the good fortune of isolating the organism from the environment on top of the Beaver Lodge and then from the Beaver Dam, working closely with investigators from the CDC and also the South Carolina Bureau of Laboratories. And so we learned quite a lot about the ecology. When we published this, they referred to an editorial called Leave It to Beaver.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that story. That's a great one. And for being with us and explaining this. We really appreciate it. We've been talking with Bruce Klein, professor of medical microbiology and immunology at UW-Manis. Thank you for very, very much for listening. And we'll see if Larry's feeling better tomorrow. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thank you for being with us.